Hey, Unchained listeners. As you know, it's hard keeping up with the fast-paced world of crypto, so we've got just the thing for you. Subscribe to our free Unchained Daily newsletter at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. You'll get the latest crypto news and original articles from our reporters, as well as summaries of other happenings in bullet points, plus our meme of the day, all curated and written by our amazing team. It's still your no-hype resource for all things crypto, just in newsletter form. Sign up at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Again, the URL is unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Hey, all. Before we begin, a couple of announcements. First, Unchained has a new logo and website. You may have noticed the new podcast thumbnail in your podcast player or on YouTube. This change has been a long time coming, and I think the new redesign looks awesome. As we've done on YouTube and on the podcast platforms, we've also now retired the unconfirmed brand on the site. So now the Friday shows will also be branded Unchained. Be sure to check out the beautiful new redesign at unchainedpodcast.com. Second, my book publishes in less than 2 months. I've been sending it to a few early readers to get blurbs and also for ideas for NFTs. And I just wanted to share with you one early reader's reaction. This person, quote, absolutely devoured the book in 2 days, which is pretty crazy because I wrote a really fat book. They also said they were enthralled, their word, and that they felt the book really brought to life the various players included in it. This is someone who's been involved in the space for years, but was not right in the middle of the action, and they could not put it down. So if you're looking for a good read that's all about crypto, pre-order The Cryptopians, Idealism, Greed, Lies, and the Making of the First Big Cryptocurrency Craze today at bit.ly/cryptopians. That's bit.ly/CRYPTOPIANS. The book comes out 2/22/22, and so you'll have it just in time for spring break. Again, pre-order The Cryptopians at bit.ly/cryptopians. And now, on to the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Unchained, your no-hype resource for all things crypto. I'm your host, Laura Shin, a journalist with over 2 decades of experience. I started covering crypto 6 years ago, and as a senior editor at Forbes, was the first mainstream media reporter to cover cryptocurrency full-time. This is the January 4th, 2022 episode of Unchained. Happy New Year's, everyone! Buy, earn, and spend crypto on the Crypto.com app. New users can enjoy zero credit card fees on crypto purchases in the first 30 days. Download the Crypto.com app and get $25 with the code Laura. Link in the description. Today's topic is the 2022 crypto markets. Here to discuss are Larry Cermak, VP of Research at The Block, and Igor Igambardiev, Director of Research and Data at The Block. Welcome, Larry and Igor.
Hey, Laura. Great to be here again.
Hey.
So let's start by discussing what the state of the crypto markets was at the end of 2021. What would you say were the top line points from last year?
Sure. So for 2021, I would say we saw crypto really reach mainstream for the first time, or at least trying to attempt to reach mainstream. We saw obviously massive upkick of institutional adoption with the announcement of Tesla buying Bitcoin. Everything kicked off significantly. Like you could see it even on our research business. The interest just went like up like 100x on the institutional side because with Tesla, it kind of breached people's mainstream. And then also it was the year of layer one networks outside of Ethereum getting a lot of adoption. And then I would say last one, just NFTs completely going bananas and just reaching even the normal people that normally don't care about crypto, don't care about finance, don't care about changing money, but they care about some like digital scarcity and they wanted to own a piece of something.
And Igor, what do you think?
So I also like saw a lot of adoption, even in terms of some like new tokens like SHIB and some Flocky tokens, because a lot of people use like Coinbase wallet to trade all these tokens. And we also so a lot of adoption in terms of talking like people and trying to like create some DAO for buying some NFTs or some like rare stuff. So yeah, we'll definitely see more adoption in the next year.
So this was the first time after the most recent Bitcoin halving where we didn't see a blow off top near the end of the calendar year, like roughly kind of 18 months after. Why do you think we didn't see that? And I did see at least one person, Natasha Che, tweeting that she thought we'd entered the so-called super cycle, in which we stop going through these crazy bull markets and then have these long bear markets afterward. And instead now the market will kind of go up in a more steady fashion. What do you think? Do you agree, or you know, what does this indicate to you?
Yeah, I would say I definitely roughly agree with that idea. I think in general, there's probably going to be still some bear markets. And as we saw, like crypto is still relatively correlated to what happens in macro. So there could be some bear markets, but I think they're going to be much shorter because the space has just matured so much. Like if we compare it to something like 2018 and 2019, back then, I think the market was still not 100% sure that crypto was something that was going to like stay and that was going to actually be used by people. And I think we've breached that now where, you know, there's a lot of people that use crypto. There's a lot of people that rely on crypto. And I think it's become obvious to retail investors and institutional investors that this is something that's going to stay. And I think the biggest difference from what we saw, you know, 2017, 2018 is that there's now not perfect correlation of all the assets in crypto. It behaves much more as a more mature asset class where you have like different subsectors like NFTs, like DeFi 2.0, like DeFi and a few other ones that behave almost like in its own cycles. And I think that by itself is really bullish because it shows that, like I said, the crypto is just more accepted and more viewed as a mature asset class. And I don't think there's going to be another like 2 or 3 year bear market.
And Igor, what do you think?
Yeah, so I totally agree with Larry, to be honest, because yeah, in this cycle, we have a lot of like narratives like NFT, like gaming, all these things. And also another reason is we also saw a lot of, you know, like mainstream influence, like TikTokers, all people just trying to jump in various like cryptos. And this is a fresh money on this market. So I think, yeah, that's also one of the reasons why we stay like on the top.
And crypto has just like become so interesting to young people, I think. Like that, I mean, it was a little bit of a case like 2017, 2018, but now it's almost like a interesting thing to do. And for a lot of people that I talk to, it's more interesting than like trading equities and being interested in that, because this is just like much freer market. And I think that's also affecting like how people are viewing this, because younger people in general are just like so much more inclined to be interested in this asset class. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
All right. So yeah, I kind of broadly agree with you both. And for that reason, I'm super excited to see what happens in 2022, because I think it'll be kind of just like something that we really haven't seen before in crypto. You know, I think before people kind of expected the cycles to happen a certain way. And, you know, I think this year it will be something new and different. So at the end of 2021, you guys released this monster report on kind of all things across the whole entire sector. So I'm actually just going to now kind of go somewhat step by step through the report. And so why don't we start with the first topic in the report, which was actually one of the biggest shifts last year, which was the change in mining, particularly Bitcoin mining, because China banned mining in the country. So why don't we just talk a little bit about what it was that you guys were seeing in terms of the state of Bitcoin mining and basically what you think will happen going forward.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously the biggest development last year was the China ban, which completely shifted dynamics. Like before, Bitcoin was predominantly mined in China. I mean, even though the dominance was like slightly decreasing, it was super important. You know, all mining machines are still made in China, or the vast majority. In China, there is a super cheap power as well. So it made a lot of sense. And when China stepped in, it completely changed the dynamic of like where mining happens now. And so we've gone from, I think, a little bit more than 50% in China to now zero. And a lot of that hash rate has moved to other countries like Kazakhstan. A lot of it has gone into the US. So now, you know, yesterday, and I think, I mean, just like these days, Foundry USA, the US-based mining pool that only mines in the US, is number one, which was not even close to being true before this happened in China. And, you know, mining is now more common in Kazakhstan, a little bit more in Russia as well, Malaysia, A lot of that has shifted. And I think it, what it showed people is that despite that massive like 50% hash rate drop, it was relatively fast how the hash rate relocated, and it was relatively kind of painless of what ended up happening. I mean, there's obviously a bad price effect, but just in general, the hash rate has recovered in about like 4 or 5 months. Like if we look at hash rate today, it should be already a little bit higher than what it was prior to the crash. And that just shows that Bitcoin is more resilient than I think some people thought. That it was almost like one of the things that people always brought up is that it's too reliant on China in terms of mining. And you know, now we saw that in 3 or 4 months that can be fixed and nothing really bad ended up happening in that time. So I think it was just kind of a resilience test. And it's also probably to the benefit that a lot more mining right now happens in the US, which is just much more predictable. China was always a risk where you had no idea what they would do.
So to be honest, yeah, I'm not like an expert in the sphere of Bitcoin mining, but yeah, I could like say something about mining in Russia. Because yeah, you know, like in Russia, we have like a lot of cheap energy, mainly because of like electric stations on rivers. But also we don't have like any understanding of regulations in the future. So this is the reason why a couple of my friends who were miners, which like rented some like space, just moved to Georgia mainly, only because of the lack of regulation right now. And also like a lot of like talks about regulation in Russia right now is kind of negative. So yeah, people just don't know what's the next move of like Russia governance.
And do you guys want to say anything also about the state of Ethereum mining, particularly after the implementation of EIP-1559? Because obviously that did have an effect on transaction fees for Ethereum miners.
Yeah, what I would say, what I think it was the most surprising to me in 2021 was that Ethereum miners actually ended up making almost exactly the same amount of money in revenue as Bitcoin miners. If you make the assumption that they sell right after mining it. And there are two reasons for that. I mean, one is that Ethereum interest and price obviously just increased significantly more than Bitcoins. But second, also that prior to EIP 1559, but even a little bit after that, Ethereum is used a lot. And because of that, people are willing to pay really high fees. So if you look at like the ratio between the fees and the total mined amount for Ethereum, is obviously super, super high. For Bitcoin, it's quite low. So that was the most surprising to me. But I would say just in general, you know, after EIP 1559, revenues decreased a bit. Obviously, miners make a little bit less. But just generally, you know, there's now this like expectation of the merge happening at some point in the future and Ethereum actually switching off mining. So I think miners are becoming a little bit more cautious of that. But just in general, you know, generating $15 billion is a lot of money on a yearly basis.
In this year, miners found a new like revenue stream is MEV extraction. So yeah, I don't think that like right now like MEV could help miners to like avoid all drawbacks from EIP. Yeah, but anyway, it's like additional from 2 to I think 10% of revenue. So
Okay. All right, so now let's talk about venture funding. There was just a lot of news that you guys had in your report about that. So why don't we just discuss kind of in an overview what you found in terms of the state of venture funding in 2021 and where you think we're going for 2022, and then we can talk a little bit about some of the specific trends.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think like the one really quick summary would be that venture funding overall has just increased significantly. Like when you look at the chart that we have in the report, kind of looking at the VC funding year over year, I mean, we've gone from about like 3 or 4 billion to about 25 billion just like year over year. And that in basically any chart, when you see something like that, just a complete outlier, it's very significant. And I mean, no one could miss all of the announcements that we saw from VC firms over the last like 3 or 4 months, raising billions of dollars of capital. And all of that obviously ends up trickling into crypto. A lot of it ends up going into seed investments, not too much of it into like late stage opportunities. But just in general, you know, like 2 years ago, it was basically just crypto VCs and no one really interested. Like all the traditional VCs just pulled out completely. And now you have pretty much all the VC firms, like even the ones that are not really announced, they're all interested. A lot of them are our clients and they're like thinking about their strategy to enter crypto. And I think part of that is that it's just now like much more investable. You can make much, much more comparisons that are closer to traditional finance. They can think about DeFi in a way, how they think about equity in some worlds. They can make much closer comparisons. So I would say, you know, just in summary, just venture funding overall exploded completely. The deal size also increased significantly. So before that, you know, it was obviously like 4 or 5 times smaller. Now it's not that uncommon to see like $70 to $80 million in pre-product valuations for some crypto projects, and it's just a function of so much capital being on the sidelines, so much capital for you know, that's competing for a fixed number of deals. And if there's a really good deal and really good company or protocol that's developing something new, it has a massive premium, and it's very common now to see like $80-$90 million in pre-product valuation. So it's a little bit crazy, but just in general, yeah, overall, just a massive explosion.
One of the reasons for this is that right now we have some, yeah, like this multi-chain world. So a lot of projects just trying to launch some forks from Ethereum, for example. And we just love this because, for example, they didn't invest in something like Curve, for example. So for them, it's a good to invest in similar project on Solana, for example. And also like the second thing is, with this like multi-chain world, a lot of projects, just something like, Polkadot parachains, for example. And, I think right now we just like in the start of the wave of this like parachain projects and some like Cosmos, new blockchains. So yeah, we'll see in the next year.
Yeah. And speaking about the size of the deals that Larry mentioned, you know, not only has that increased, but also we've seen so many more crypto unicorns. And I just wondered, like, do you think that the market is just kind of getting a little bit too frothy because there's just so much money pouring in and they're all competing? And so is it like just kind of irrationally bumping up the valuations, or what's your take on that?
I think for sure, like there's a lot of, there's a lot of examples I can think of where, you know, for example, you know, protocols that still haven't shipped are now basically trading on the secondary market, like $2 billion valuation. That seems a little bit crazy. And yeah, now there's like 50 plus crypto unicorns, and it used to be just exchanges. Like two or three years ago, it was basically just exchanges that were super profitable. And now you have all these other companies like infrastructure, you know, like protocol development companies. And it's just become almost like expected, right? Like when you see a fundraising round of a company that is generating significant amount of revenue, there's a big premium on it being a crypto company, and VC investors just in general and M&A investors, they kind of price this in and say, you know, this will likely become a much larger industry in the next few years, so probably there should be a big premium. And even like you look at something like Coinbase, which has obviously gone public last year, it's still trading at like $40 or $50 billion in market cap, or maybe even larger, higher now. And when you make comparisons in basically all the metrics to like any other exchanges or any other, you know, FX businesses, the difference is like 5x or more higher than those businesses in the traditional world. So there's just a big premium on crypto overall. I think this will probably continue being this way just because it's a very kind of interesting industry for people to allocate capital to. And there's not that many opportunities to allocate in equity markets. And obviously with Coinbase kind of opening the floodgates to going public, there is now an expectation for a lot of these exchanges to do the same, or for these infrastructure companies, or even something like OpenSea, right? I mean, they're just really big premium on all those companies.
Yeah, I do wonder if it's one of those things where it's kind of like directionally correct, but then for individual bets, it won't be. So it sort of like makes sense and then also doesn't make sense. Yeah. So let's now maybe talk about some of the specific verticals within the venture investment space. just looking at the report, it looked to me like DeFi and NFTs were attracting a lot of VC money. But why don't you just talk a little bit about kind of trends within crypto in terms of what's attracting money and what you expect to continue to attract a significant proportion of investment?
Yeah, I think the most interesting opportunities for investors are always the ones where they see some sort of a liquid exit or where they see an opportunity to obviously make the most money. So earlier in the year 2021, it was DeFi, and it probably continued until like summer or something. Then DeFi started underperforming a little bit. So then it was NFTs. So there were a lot of investments into obviously something like OpenSea, Rarible, investments that in some way give you exposure to the NFT market. And towards the end of the year, we saw a complete shift to just like gaming companies, NFT, you know, using NFTs in games that has sucked out so much capital, you know, so that includes games, includes gaming guilds. Axie Infinity really was the role model for the play to earn games. And now you constantly see these deals funded. And you also see, again, like very traditional VC companies trying to get as much exposure as they can to these gaming companies and just using crypto in general in gaming. Because you look at something like Axie Infinity, which is a very liquid, it has a very liquid governance token, and it's trading much higher than like the AAA gaming studios. They're gaming studios, they're producing the games that are played by, you know, hundreds of millions of people. And they're trading overall, you know, that studio is trading at less than what Axie is doing. And it is trading in a very liquid form. So obviously that becomes, for investors, this is an opportunity where they see this is probably under monetized. So a lot of the games right now can be making orders of magnitude more money. And that's becoming very interesting now for them. What I would say just in general, like from the deals and some of the stuff that I've seen, it's almost embarrassing. Like look at the games that are raising $100 million valuations. And it's like click-based games that I used to play, you know, in 2002. And they're trading at $1 billion plus valuations. It's a little bit absurd right now, and I think that will definitely end up collapsing. But the trend will probably continue, and some gaming studios will, you know, start implementing NFTs. I'm pretty sure about that.
Igor, what about you? What other trends in VC investment do you see that you want to talk about?
I saw a lot of interest in like DeFi protocols on new L1s, not only like Forks, for example, something of Uniswap, but also some protocols who try to create some, you know, like more sophisticated earn opportunities using something like options and so on. And for sure, because of like Solana high TPS, we could see even more like better projects, which we couldn't see on something like Ethereum, or maybe even on the rollups, to be honest.
Okay.
There was also one other trend, and that was not just funding DeFi on L1s, but also funding L1s and funding L2s. There was a lot of investment also in these areas where, like, now people are almost expecting the next, you know, year of 2022 becoming the year of finally some rollup adoption. So a lot of the rollup solutions raised a lot of money, and also a lot of DeFi solutions obviously building on these rollup solutions. So I think just overall, L2s obviously raised also a tremendous amount of capital, and we see it in, you know, Matter Labs, Starkware, all these development companies. They're raising at really high valuations, and it's because there's an expectation of them eventually having tokens and becoming liquid. And especially after what we saw with L1s this year, you know, all of them basically popping off like crazy. If some of these L2 solutions end up getting some adoption similar to L1s, you can expect a similar trend. A lot of the capital will end up going there. And I'm pretty convinced that's going to be a trend of this year as well.
Yeah. One other thing actually that I noticed was that crypto financial services was also a popular sector for VC funding. And by that, you know, I mean things like payments and lending. But one thing that I wondered was, you know, obviously that sector is seeing a lot of uncertainty, at least here in the US, due to regulatory issues. And I wondered, do you feel like that's going to affect funding in that space? Or, you know, are you noticing hesitation on the parts of investors there?
I would say there's definitely a lot of hesitation in terms of lending companies, but there's a lot of interest in companies like NYDIG that just facilitate institutional investment. And that I believe we also count into financial services. So I would say overall, probably, I think even like companies like BlockFi, you know, Celsius as well, somewhat based in the US, they're definitely facing a lot of uncertainty. And the SEC has made it very clear that they don't like those businesses to be run in the US and they don't give it their blessing. So I think in the lending side, absolutely. A lot of that will probably end up moving offshore as well. But just overall, I think like financial services is a very logical way forward where like you try to extract some value and try to facilitate a lot of the institutional capital going into crypto. So I think investment overall will probably remain similar. But yeah, in terms of lending, there's a lot of uncertainty.
Let's also talk about M&A, which was at a record high. How do you think we're going to see that trend go in 2022?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was at a record high, but we almost expected it to be even higher last year with Coinbase going public and them having a lot of capital. It's still, there wasn't really any single like massive acquisition that we've seen yet. There wasn't really much consolidation. And I think the reason for that was because, you know, none of the companies actually struggled. A lot of the companies, when they ran out of money, like for example, you know, when BlockFi had some issues with the GBTC trade, they just did this and raised money like that within a couple of days. Because why not, right? Like there's a lot of capital in the markets. And because of that, there wasn't much need of consolidation because there just wasn't a lot of companies struggling last year. This can definitely change next year. But I think in general, we'll see a trend of company going public and then trying to acquire more companies. I mean, Coinbase has done it a little bit. None of the acquisitions were, you know, enormous, but I think this will continue being a trend. And financial services, probably data companies will consolidate a lot. Like it's, you know, in data companies, you now have like probably 100 plus companies doing data and crypto. And it's a very commoditized market. And I think we'll see a lot of consolidation there. But just in general, because a lot of money ends up going to tradable like token stuff, because of that, we haven't seen much. And we've seen, interestingly enough, like some token mergers and M&A as well, like with Polygon, for example, being one. There are a few others that were really interesting. So I think that will also be a trend in the coming years too.
Igor, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, maybe. So, yeah, we just saw that like acquisitions between various DAO in crypto is not something special because, yeah, even like 2 days ago, I think we saw Rally Capital and Faye Protocol acquisition. Before this, we have Nucifer and Keep Network and even like in the 2020, we saw a lot of projects was like acquired by Ayorn. So I think we will see just trend on this like DAO like merge and acquisition in the current year.
Yeah, I almost expect that to continue in a bigger way, even maybe than in the traditional startup space. So in a moment, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of these trends, particularly Layer 1 and DeFi. But first, a quick word from the sponsors who make this show possible. Join over 10 million people using Crypto.com, the easiest place to buy, earn, and spend over 150 cryptocurrencies. New users enjoy zero credit card fees on crypto purchases in their first 30 days. With Crypto.com Earn, you can get industry-leading interest rates of up to 8.5% on over 40 coins, including Bitcoin, and earn up to 14% on stablecoins. With the Crypto.com Visa card, you can spend your crypto anywhere. Enjoy up to 8% cash back instantly, plus 100% rebates for your Netflix, Spotify, and Amazon Prime subscriptions, and zero annual fees. Download the Crypto.com app and get $25 with the code Laura. Link in the description.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Back to my conversation with Larry and Igor. So we've kind of briefly touched on this competition amongst the layer ones, and I'm sure we're all aware it was early on Binance Smart Chain, then briefly, very briefly, Cardano, and then Solana obviously was a big, you know, new layer one to emerge. And then at the end of the year, really Avalanche and maybe even Terra. So how would you guys characterize this race at the layer one level?
I would say just in general, there were so many new retail participants that wanted to try DeFi and couldn't. So even like for me, anecdotally, when a friend comes to me and they want to put in, you know, a few $1,000, like obviously I'm not going to tell them to go use Ethereum if they're going to end up paying like 10% of their investment in fees. And then so we ran into this issue where Ethereum was being used so much and was being pushed to its limits so much that it just wasn't appealing to a lot of the newcomers. That's what Binance like really capitalized on, obviously, with Binance Smart Chain. They were the first chain that really capitalized on EVM compatibility. So it allowed, you know, it allowed teams to basically just fork the projects that already existed on Ethereum and just make it a lot cheaper. So just in general, we ran into this trend of like people wanting to use DeFi but being unable to because it was just they were just priced out completely. And because of this, you know, when you have something like Ethereum, it's almost like the goal, right? It's almost like something that those protocols aspire to be in terms of market cap. And all these L1 protocols, they promise unlimited upside. It's always like, you know, if everything works out well, like we're going to have this much usage, we're going to be at this market cap. And that attracted a lot of people like being interested in getting exposure to these. So I think like Solana as well was quite notable because it was the first one that was able to bootstrap its own development ecosystem without relying on Ethereum so much. And that was mainly because of its kind of, you know, of Sam and FTX just kind of incentivizing them as much as possible, almost like guaranteeing listings if those projects were interesting. So just in general, there were so many different L1s that started getting some adoption, and because of that, price usually followed, and people wanted to get exposure to it because there's like unlimited upside compared to something like DeFi, where you already know, like you can make some comparisons to traditional finance or something else, but with L1s there really isn't a pricing metric, so no one knows what these tokens should be trading at, and because of that everyone's like aspiring to be Ethereum. And because of that, like I think there, it was just really an interesting sector for people to allocate capital to, because what we saw after Solana, like now people are just chasing these. Like, you know, basically this week and last week, like Near is getting a lot of this attention, and it keeps going from one to another to another to another, and it's like this continuous hype and continuous like basically free competition of these L1s to try to get users, try to get developers, try to make it interesting for users to start using their chain with like incentives and stuff. So I think we'll continue seeing this, but I do anticipate this morphing a little bit more into the L2s in this year.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I really also was impressed by like Solana in terms of like bootstrapping of developers activity, because yeah, right now we have some kind of technical debt, which is like EVM compatibility, because a lot of developer tools, right, specifically for EVM, and a lot of like DeFi primitives like Uniswap, like Balancer, like some lending protocols like Compound or Aave also write in Solidity, and you just couldn't use them on something like Solana or even Near. So this is the reason why we also saw a trend for building some kind of like EVM environment on chains like Solana and Near, which is like Neon EVM and Aurora for sure. But yeah, I really want to see that in the next year we go see more like compatibility and interoperability between various chains, because even with like rollups right now, we also need to use like some new smart contract language, like Cairo, for example, for Starkware. And I know that, for example, Starkware spent a lot of effort and time of creating some like developer tools. But yeah, anyway, right now, yeah, is an issue that if you want to bootstrap your blockchain, you definitely need some kind of like EVM compatibility.
Yeah, well, I wonder, you know, once Ethereum shifts to Ethereum 2.0, probably sometime in the first half of next year, how do you think that's going to affect this race or competition at layer one? And do you feel that any of these chains that kind of benefited from the high fees on Ethereum this past year will have lasting traction? Or do you feel like once they're scaling on Ethereum, then we're going to see capital flow back to Ethereum?
I personally think that there will continue to be multi-chain opportunities. I think, you know, everyone says like Ethereum 2.0, maybe start of next year. I would challenge it a little bit. I think it's going to be much longer than that. I think what's going to be obviously more important in the short term is just the L2s and like scaling through rollups. I think for Ethereum 2.0, there's a lot of uncertainty, and not just around timing, but also like how well will this actually end up working? How much will this fragment liquidity on these protocols? How compatible are they going to be across the board? And I think my view has changed on this significantly over the last 2 years, because before we had basically like Neo, Tron, and like these blockchains that basically made like, the, you know, I don't want to say the dumbest, but the kind of the easiest compromises that they could to get as much adoption as they could. Now you see a little bit more sophistication. You see L1s just in general compromising in ways it makes sense. So Solana, for example, is making the bet that this will all have to scale on chain in order not to fragment liquidity and in order to just retain users on this one layer. And I think these like different approaches and these parameters that you're playing with are going to be important. Like, for example, for something like games, it's not too important to be like as decentralized as possible. It's important that you have the ownership of the assets, and it's important that you have some like regulatory arbitrage, basically. Whereas for financial services, you know, I keep going back to this, but like I would not feel comfortable putting like tens of millions of dollars on Solana today, because you just don't have the certainty of it like being constantly up. And if something happens during that time, and you know, price moves too much, your capital can be at risk. So for that sense, I would feel much more comfortable keeping it on something as decentralized and as with the highest uptime possible, which is basically Ethereum right now. So it just, to me, it always depends on like the use case that you're going for. And I think there are going to be some more use case specific chains down the line. And I don't think even with like Ethereum 2.0 and even with rollups, like I think a lot of the L1s obviously will end up correcting, and the ones that don't end up getting adoption, don't end up getting developers, will all trend to zero. But I think there will still be opportunities. And I think we will end up living in a multi-chain world that has to cooperate with one another.
Yeah. So I also think that even with this transition from like monolithic execution environment to something which like Vitalik, like roll-up centric vision, we would have some like space for various like blockchains and even like side chains, for example, like Ronin for Axie Infinity. So you don't need to like store all data and execute all transactions in one chain anyway. So yeah, even something like personally, for sure, like Cosmos vision is like much better than, for example, something like Polkadot, because you would have like blockchain for every app which you want. So if you want to like some lending protocol, you would have like lending protocol blockchain. You could like connect this blockchain from various bridges to like Ethereum, to other Cosmos blockchains, or even to Polkadot. So yeah, you definitely don't need to like execute all transactions and all applications on one blockchain.
Yeah, Larry, what's your opinion about which interoperability ecosystem will gain more traction?
Yeah, I think just in general, I agree with Igor that Cosmos is the most interesting in terms of the goal and kind of the design of the protocol, where it, you know, we've seen the adoption that Terra was able to get, and then the more that happens, and the more these apps can interoperate with one another, the more interesting it's going to be. I think just in general, what's stopping Cosmos to become more talked about and become the narrative is just that they don't have great token economics, and the token is not really connected to like the performance of the apps that end up building on Cosmos. And because of that, a lot of the, you know, there just hasn't been too much interest around Cosmos outside of the apps building on top of it, and Cosmos doesn't benefit too much from it. But in terms of design, I totally agree with Igor. I think it's just a superior design, but it's just one approach. I think like that's kind of what I would want to leave people with, is no one really knows what will happen. No one knows if Ethereum 2.0 will work out. No one knows if rollups will end up getting significant adoption. It's all experimenting right now, and everyone's taking different approaches. And eventually, over the long term, the best approach will end up taking the most market share. And I think that's one of the great things about this ecosystem, is that, you know, maybe Tron did well over the short term, maybe EOS did okay over the short term, but over the long term, all of these solutions that don't take great approaches will trend to zero. And that's how it should be. It should be perfect competition for these solutions, and that will end up pushing this to be more friendly for users, and we'll end up, you know, onboarding as many customers as possible.
All right. And so we're going to talk about DeFi in a moment, but we did touch very briefly on layer two. I don't know if you wanted to kind of talk a little bit more about where you think that's going to go, because clearly that space is sort of, yeah, at the ground level, and it's kind of up in the air where things are going to go with that.
Yeah, Igor will probably have more elaborate thoughts here. I'll just kind of summarize. So like right now, we already have optimistic rollups in production. You have Arbitrum and Optimism. They've progressed quite a bit since they launched, but I would say almost everyone would say that the adoption has been completely underwhelming so far compared to like what it was hyped up to be, even what like I expected, I think Igor as well. In general, it's because you have all these like cheap alternatives that make different trade-offs, which normal users don't really care about that much. Like, you know, most people don't want to wait 7 days for withdrawing their tokens. Most users don't want to pay $3 or $4 fees if they can pay a few cents on Solana. And because of that, I think they got very little adoption so far. You know, there are solutions that are trying to tackle that. There are solutions that will make withdrawals like much faster if you pay higher fees. And also, I believe that Arbitrum and Optimism will eventually do a token that will start a massive interest. I mean, it's always what starts all of this. Like you look at like interest in Compound or interest in Aave prior to the token dropping basically for Compound and then more tokens, there was almost no interest. And after that, you know, you can build the incentives in a way where, for example, if people that end up bridging over, or if people just end up using the dApps on these chains somehow get rewarded, you get some wider distribution that I think can start another wave. And then the second part of L2s is obviously the ZK rollups. To me, that's the more long-term oriented solution. I mean, there are a lot of people that disagree. A lot of people think that optimistic rollups are also the optimal solution. I personally think that like something like Starknet and ZK Sync will end up being a significant narrative of this year. And both of them are definitely planning tokens as well. And I think it's just a more logical and a more pragmatic approach. And I think it will end up getting quite a bit of interest this year.
So yeah, I also think that like optimistic rollups is only like short-term solution. Yeah, but as Larry said, right now, they're like already in production. And people really use them even with this like long withdrawal time because of like some new protocols like Hog Exchange who helped people with like instant swaps, because I think like operators of this exchange just like verify like all roll-up transactions. But yeah, anyway, like optimistic rollups is a good way only because of EVM compatibility right now. So people could just reuse existing Ethereum instruments like Hardcat, Web3JS, and anything else. And also they could just like redeploy like Uniswap or Aave or anything. Yeah, but ZK rollups are definitely like better alternative to optimistic rollups. But like the main reason which this is like, I think not a good solution for like the next half a year or something, is not only that they're not in production right now, but also because of like the lack of like general like EVM execution, because you need to use some like new specific smart contract language to do all this ZK magic. So you need like some like toolbox for these contracts. You need some like some framework and some like basic contracts, like something like Open Zeppelin contracts, which we already use for like ERC-20 tokens on Ethereum. Also, like these ZK rollups are kind of like more expensive in terms of executions. I don't think that we could see like more like decentralizations in terms of like relayers who would like execute all transactions and generate all these mathematic proofs. But I don't think that we need decentralization in these terms, because anyway, we have like MAT and also we have Ethereum security for this transaction. So yeah, I think ZK rollups are definitely like long-term solution for scaling and not only for Ethereum.
Yeah, so I agree with Igor for that. And I think for ZK rollups specifically, the lack of EVM compatibility will be something that will end up basically delaying that. Because exactly like Igor said, there's not enough code that can be forked. And because of that, you'll have to go through the exact same process as Solana did, basically finding new developers, incentivizing these new developers to develop there. And because of that, it will take longer. But what I think like listeners should realize is that actually there are limitations to EVM as well. So like going through your own language in most cases is the optimal solution if you're going for full scalability, but it's the more painful one. And Solana has seen exactly the same issue. So I think it will end up happening this year. It will be slower than people realize, but it will end up being the breakthrough, I believe, of 2022.
All right. So let's now talk about DeFi. How would you say that sector overall, like DeFi tokens, how did they perform versus Bitcoin and Ether? And then we can go into specific DeFi.
So yeah, we saw DeFi doing really well in Q1 and Q2 of last year. You know, Aave, Compound, Uniswap, all these protocols performed incredibly well in the first half of the year. And then we ran into a massive slump in Q3 and Q4, where if you basically chart DeFi or any sort of DeFi token over Ethereum, it's basically a straight line down. And I think the main reason for that has basically been dilution of capital. So, you know, you now have multiple different L1s, and they're obviously earlier stage opportunities to invest in these primitives on them. So if there's even a 5% chance that something like Solana will end up taking over Ethereum, those primitives obviously are more interesting to you if they're at much smaller valuations than something like Uniswap or Compound on Ethereum. So I think we ran into that issue where capital just got diluted into other protocols and people started chasing DeFi protocols in these ecosystems. And then the second issue was that there were just new narratives, basically. We saw it a little bit with DeFi 2.0 narrative and just in general with NFTs as well, where DeFi was almost like exhausted. And in my opinion, it was also difficult to justify investing in it in super high valuations. So if you see Uniswap trading at like $25 billion, you're looking at like 3 or 4x upside maximum, for, at least in my opinion. Whereas if you look at other like earlier stage opportunities or different layer one ecosystems, you can justify much easier to invest in them. And because of that, we've just seen a massive slump and narratives moving in different directions.
Yeah, and I just agree with Larry, yeah.
Okay, so why don't we move quickly through some of these different DeFi sectors. One thing, you know, that was interesting to me is DEX volume peaked in May and hasn't really recovered. What's your sense of why that is occurring?
In May, I did one of like research about like DEX volumes, and I find that a lot of DEX volumes are created by some kind of like arbitrage bots, which mainly use like SushiSwap and Uniswap version 2. And also in May, we see this like SHIB mania with a lot of like retail attention. But after this, we also saw like listing of SHIB on like main exchange like Coinbase and Binance. So I just think that like most of this DEX volume just moved to centralized exchange because, you know, like even because of like Ethereum high fees, people centralized exchange are more like friendly for like retail users. So I think it's definitely like one of the reasons.
Yeah, I think Igor is totally right. It was like it completely corresponds with the Shiba mania. And initially it wasn't listed on many exchanges, then listed on FTX, Binance, and a few other larger ones that people can just could just easily go to trade it. And obviously when you're dealing with like, you know, $100 fees versus just going on an exchange, especially for these guys that are buying, you know, $200, $300, it just makes a lot more sense. So I totally agree with you. It was just like a massive retail mania on that side of things. And then also we keep going back to this, but a lot of that ended up moving to L1s as well. So you know, PancakeSwap, for example, its volume has gone up significantly. I mean, initially it was barely competing with Uniswap, and then at some point it had larger volumes than Uniswap did. And a lot of that was just kind of like chasing some questionable project, like some of it like basically Ponzi based. But just overall, I think it was mainly the fee issue. And like Igor mentioned, just people moving to centralized exchanges and centralized exchanges having enough liquidity.
Lending has always been a really big draw on DeFi. What trends did you see there, and where do you think that will go in 2022?
I would say in terms of DeFi, like there weren't any like trends that stood out too much. I would say just in general, you know, the more these tokens are traded and the more these tokens are interested to people, the higher the demand for lending against them will be. And in this case, we saw exactly that. It's kind of like lending is a very agnostic thing to agnostic instrument to markets. It's not like too interesting, but it's a very interesting, very important primitive for people to have access to in order to, you know, be able to borrow against these assets. So in general, like I didn't see any trends that stood out too much in terms of lending outside of some of them, obviously, again, like moving to other L1s, but maybe Igor has something.
So yeah, we also saw like a lot of new like DeFi 2.0 like protocols use some, you know, like stable coins, like USDC, some like Frax thing. When I said like about like these protocols, I mean something like OHM Forex or something like Shiba Swap, because I was kind of shocked when I found that like all uni tokens from Compound were like borrowed only for some like Shiba Swap farm. So we will definitely see in this year like more use cases for using tokens from like Compound and Aave in some like new like crazy farms like in the last year.
Okay, so we're running out of time. So which trends in DeFi do you feel like were the most notable and are things that you're going to be looking out for in 2022?
I would say from my side, obviously, you know, recently DeFi 2.0 was the most noticeable trend by far. Like Olympus DAO kind of changed how DeFi protocols think about liquidity. And I would say in general, and we saw this a couple of weeks ago with Yearn, DeFi like 1.0 protocols or whatever you want to call them, the original DeFi protocols, revamping their token economics to be just more easier to control. So in this case, you try to decrease emissions and try to make it more compelling for people to buy. I think that's going to become the new standard in the coming months, where a lot of the earlier DeFi protocols will just revamp their token economics. So it's more, again, so there's some reason for people to get excited by them again and for them to actually hold them. We started with this trend, obviously, with Compound, like just doing liquidity mining. And because of that, you have high emissions. You know, it turns out that if you give people free money, they tend to sell it and they tend to use it to buy stuff in real life as well. And that obviously has negative effects on the price and investment interest in these assets. So I think we'll see a lot of that. I think we'll see a lot less liquidity mining, a lot less emissions. Like Uniswap kind of paved the way by stopping that on the base layer. Like SushiSwap still does a lot of emissions, so I think we'll see that stop soon, and a lot of token economics revamps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm really interested in like more like protocols which create new wild opportunities. Like as I said, something like with options or structured products, like Rebound, for example. because this is like a new way to earn wild and not something like lending or like liquidity providing. So we will definitely see more products and for sure on like other chains than Ethereum.
All right. So one trend that I definitely want to draw out is there were just so many exploits in DeFi this year. What's your take on that? Is that just like something people will have to put up with? Or what do you think the industry is going to do about that, if anything?
Yeah, I think Igor should just talk here because that's his area of specialty.
So yeah, we saw a lot of DeFi exploits. But the root cause of like most of them is just like Oracle misuse, which is like bad practice, even like from something like 2018. And also right now we saw only exploits on EVM chains or EVM compatible chains for sure, or something like multi-chain protocols. And we didn't see something hacks, for example, on Solana. And even like a week ago, like one of the best like auditor companies on Solana, Neodyme, just found some like vulnerability in one of the main DeFi primitive for Solana. And I think that we will definitely see hacks or exploits on these new chains. But the main reason why we didn't see something like this in the last year is just the absence of like source code, open source, because competition, new protocols on new L1s just didn't want to share their public code to like absorb like market share right now. But yeah, in terms of EVM compatible chains, we will definitely see a lot more DeFi exploit, and I think even like more sophisticated than in the last year.
All right. One other thing about DeFi that I wanted to bring up was in your report, you said that you felt that bifurcation of DeFi would be inevitable. And by that, what you seem to be saying was that there would be a sort of non-KYC DeFi and then a KYC DeFi for institutions. And so I'm just curious for your thoughts on why you see that as inevitable.
Yeah, I think it's becoming like very obvious based on what Aave is doing, what Compound is doing. And when we talk to institutional clients, they're just unable to trade a lot of these things on DeFi. They're just unable to touch it without proper KYC. And because of that, these protocols are missing on billions of dollars of potential inflows, billions of dollars of capital that they can get, you know, if they slightly change their protocols. So the way I see this is that Compound, Aave, even Uniswap will create products on top of these protocols that will be more friendly to institutional investors overall, and eventually will allow them to interact with it in some sort of a KYC way. And on top of that, sourcing liquidity in DeFi in general and just giving them better yield opportunities. I mean, we constantly talk to institutional investors that ask us, like, what's the way that we can actually get access to this like 8% yields that we normally can't get anywhere else? I mean, they're used to getting like 0.1, 0.2% on their capital. And all of a sudden they see that, you know, there's billions of dollars like earning relatively high amounts in APYs. And that's appealing to them. But unfortunately, like because of regulations in the US, like it's just very difficult for them to get access to it. And because of that, Compound and Aave and Uniswap will create protocols or maybe not even protocols, but more so like just vehicles for them to use in this way. But I think like for retail investors, this will obviously be very unappealing.
All right. So let's now turn to NFTs because we're running out of time. And obviously this is going to be probably a huge trend in 2022. Something that's interesting, though, of course, is that we did see there was a spike in activity of NFT trading in August, and then volumes have really fallen. So where do you think the market's going to go in 2022?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think we've now seen basically like two hype cycles in NFTs. I mean, one was basically around March and then NFTs crashed by like 70 or 80%. And I remember thinking, okay, this is over. Like this trend was just super short. It's done. And then all of a sudden, you know, we saw like another like 10x going from there. And now if you look at the March period, it like barely shows on the chart because the other one was just so much larger. And now we're seeing a similar thing, just a complete cool down. And I think just in general, I mean, there was obviously massive hype around PFP projects, massive hype around regenerative art. And, you know, people just were trading that. They had massive FOMO. They saw a lot of people just making a lot of money out of nothing, right? And that's always just encouraging a lot of interest from retail investors too. I think my prediction would be that PFP projects will not, you know, they will not end up making infinite amount of money anymore. There'll only be a few that will be still viewed as important by people. I think a lot of this will end up going in the direction of just blockchain gaming overall. NFTs actually being used for a specific purpose, NFTs being used in financial products more, and 101 art as well, I think is going to be cool. But just overall, I mean, you know, something, the infrastructure needs to get better. I mean, we keep going back to it, but like issuing an NFT and trading NFT on Ethereum is just like completely financially unfeasible. And because of that, like almost no retail investors were like super interested. But because of that, then, you know, we saw something like Flow and NBA Top Shot, which is free to trade, like just get a ton of attention from people. So to me, there's a very clear mainstream appeal to NFTs. And I think that's going to continue being the case, and it's going to continue being popular in the future, but it's going to be more refined, you know, and it's going to be more focused on, I think, higher quality projects down the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that like non-crypto people don't really like NFTs. We just saw this, for example, like even like a month ago or something when like Ubisoft, which is like AAA game company, launched some NFT marketplace, and gamers just like tried to cancel company because of this. So saw this case with like Stalker 2. It's also like a game when people just also try to cancel a company because of plan of like integrating NFTs in AAA game. Yeah, and also like all these like integrations between NFTs and brands, we also see a lot of hate because like crypto advanced people just trying to use some like strategies to mint like a lot of NFTs in one transactions, and like just non-crypto people didn't even have any opportunity to mint, and for them I think this is just like looks like a scam. So we definitely need to do something if we want to have adoption in like NFT sector.
Yeah, that backlash is very fascinating to watch. And it's also fascinating to watch how the different brands handle that, because some of them just cancel their plans and others kind of go forward, but quietly. And yeah, we'll see what happens. And especially after the merge on Ethereum and Ethereum's proof of stake, then, you know, the kind of objection that we see from mainstream people, at least when it comes to NFTs on Ethereum, it won't exist anymore. So, you know, what will that do for adoption? Will they still hate it anyway? Or, okay, so we're definitely over time, but there's just a couple more big things I really want to cover quickly. So obviously, gaming has been another big area of NFTs. You know, I don't know if this is like exactly the same thing, but clearly there was a lot of hype around the metaverse earlier this year. So I was curious what you thought was going to happen in terms of games and maybe the metaverse too, which is sort of related.
Yeah, I would say on Metaverse, like, you know, there was obviously a lot of hype, and it all started with Facebook just changing his name, and a lot of companies now all of a sudden interested to allocate to it. But when you actually look at like the projects that exist today, like Decentraland or Sand, it's not a very like complete solution. Like if you actually try to use it, and I encourage people to try, it's not that great, right? Like it's buggy, it doesn't really work. You know, it's very overpriced because of the hype. It seems like we're in very early innings of that. I can see this trend becoming much larger in the future, but my guess would be it's like 2-3 years at least away from like getting any significant interest and any significant adoption. In terms of NFTs in games, I think we're probably closer to that. you know, like seeing Axie Infinity trade that high, and I already mentioned this, but just in general, it's appealing to gaming studios, even if they're getting backlash, because they just think that they can monetize it much better. They believe that a lot of their games are now under-monetized. Like, if you're selling a lot of money, if you're selling a lot of stuff in your games, and then have the opportunity to sell it as NFTs and then collect commission on it as it gets resold as well, that will end up being very appealing to people, to a point where it's going to be difficult for these companies to just say, no, we're not going to do this for ideological reasons, because the mispricing can be, like, you know, in billions of dollars. And so I think we'll see a few, like, AAA gaming studios introduce some NFTs in games this year. I would not be surprised. But just in general, like, you know, I already mentioned this again, but the trend of, like, now super bad and super low quality games just raising a lot of money just because they have a token and they're similar to Axie Infinity, that trend will absolutely die. Hopefully it will turn to higher quality, and it will turn to games you actually want to play, and not just a click farm that, you know, a bunch of, like, people in China just click like this on a bunch of phones and get it done. It should be a little bit more interesting than that. And I, you know, I've yet to play a single game that makes it interesting enough where, like, I want to actually spend time on it, not because I want to make money, but because I actually want to play it. And I think that will hopefully happen.
Yeah, and I just, yeah, totally agree with Larry, because we are really so early for, yeah, like, any mention of metaverse.
So there were so many other topics that we could have covered, but we're going to leave it there because these were, I think, all the main ones. I mean, there's really so many. But it's been so fun chatting with both of you. Where can people learn more about each of you and your work at The Block?
Yeah, so for me, you can find me on Twitter at Lawmaster. You can reach out to me at larry@theblockcrypto.com if you have some questions, or even for people that are interested in working crypto. We're still hiring a lot, so you can definitely reach out. And I lead the research team at The Block.
So my Twitter handle is Frank Researcher. And I think you know that I write about various DeFi hacks. So if you want to join to my data team and help us to create and build new data products, or have any suggestions for our data dashboard, just let me know.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you both so much for coming on Unchained.
Appreciate it, Laura.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining us today. To learn more about Larry, Igor, and The Block, check out the show notes for this episode. Unchained is produced by me, Laura Shin, with help from Anthony Yoon, Daniel Ness, and Mark Murdoch. Thanks for listening.